go ahead and call the meeting to order. The first thing we'd like to do is have a moment of silence for those officers who have passed away recently. Thank you. Now we're going to move to the consent agenda.
Nick, can you recess the supplemental?
Okay. First thing I'd like to do is recess the supplemental meeting. And then now move to the consent agenda for the regular meeting. First thing we have is the minutes from the last meeting. Do we have any questions or comments on any of those? Can we get a motion to approve those? Second?
This is Steve. So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Next, we have the detailed consent agenda. We're going to note that Armando is going to recuse himself because his name appears as in the listing of one of the retiring members of the fire department. So with him recused, do we have any questions or comments? And if so, someone make a motion.
I so move.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Now we're going to go to item D1. And the first thing, do we have anyone from the public who would like to make any comments?
They'll press 5-star on the phone. I can unmute them.
So I think now we're going to go to item C1, which is our go-forward communications plan that we've had a small group working on for some time.
So just as a way of introduction, first I'd like to double-check to make sure that our resources for Fleshman Hilliard, Dick Molinux, and Louis Tredeco, are you guys on the phone?
Dick is here.
Louis is here.
Great. Thank you for joining us today. I'll start off and then I will turn it over to Fleshman to talk about their work so far. Just to remind you, in November, the board indicated a desire to put together a communication plan related to our funding issues. We talked about it in February, and the board authorized hiring Fleshman Hilliard to help us with this effort. Since then, they have been working with a subcommittee, and they'll talk today about that subcommittee work. So they're going to present what they've learned from the subcommittee as well as the other work that they've done and talk about kind of a plan going forward. At the end of this, we'll need to decide if we move to the next step in developing a plan. This is a multi-step process, and also authorize budget expenditures for that next phase. So with that, Dick, did you want to take over?
Yes, I will. Thank you. You can move to the next slide. Very good. That's a great place to start. Hello, everyone. It's good to be with you again. I am Dick Molinax with Fleishman Hillard. Some of you recall we worked with the pension system in 2016. And we're happy to pick up this next step and try to develop a communications plan in concert with you to secure additional funding. And this slide indicates this is what our task is, to work with you to develop that communications plan to build support for additional funding for the Dallas First Responders. Our initial thinking is that we need to first keep the active members and retirees informed, while also beginning to reach out to those who can actually make decisions about funding, including the City of Dallas. and ultimately come to a unified solution to submit to the legislature that can be passed to secure the funding for this system. Could you go to the next one?
Does that mean, are you trying to educate the public as well, the voters who may have to approve one or two of these alternatives?
Yes, but ultimately, as we talk about this, we want to all communications are going to be built to eventually influence the city of Dallas, those who are making decisions, to agree with the pension system about what the best solution would be to go forward. And we also, but we recognize to make that happen, the city of Dallas, those making those decisions are going to have to feel like they're supported by the public and they wouldn't face some political or electoral backlash from that. So, yes, absolutely.
Good. Thank you.
Go ahead. Could you go back one, just back one really quickly? Here's what we're going, here's where we've been. As Kelly mentioned, this is a two-step process. We have completed that first step process, or will have completed it today as we present our audience-focused messaging. That comes after us doing a thorough analysis of media coverage, interviews with selected folks on the board, and leadership of the pension system, all wrapping up in the deliverable you'll see today about positioning and messaging focused on specific audiences that we believe need to be influenced to come to a positive solution. The next step also, as Kelly mentioned, would be to take this information and put it into an actual integrated communications plan to be deployed over the next 1 to 3 years, depending upon how quickly the city and the pension system are able to come to an agreement to present to the legislature. 18, please. So this first part was really to develop messaging as part of a long-term communications plan that builds the support that we've talked about. Dallas City elected officials, community leaders, and key members of the Texas legislature are all eventually going to have to be supportive of taking this step to secure funding, secure the quality first responder force that the city deserves, and secure the future of the city. Go ahead to 19.
Just clarification, Kelly.
Sure.
The legislature, it's required that we provide the legislature with a funding solution that we're fully funded within 30 years. But they're not going to do anything beyond that. I mean, they're not going to approve if we decide to do a POB bond or anything. I mean, they're just going to be happy that we've got the money, aren't they?
So it really depends what the solution is. So what the hope is if additional funding is needed, which we know there will be, that jointly the pension system and the city can come up with a solution. We're all in agreement. Depending on what that solution looks like, it may require changing the current statute 6143A-1. Might need to change because there's more city contributions or something like that, although I know the city can put in more contributions without that legislative authority. So they may just need to pass a bill to implement what everybody's agreed to. But if we go down there without a solution that
works,
then they'll be dead. The unless they change some legislation right now, the path to passing a POB is through the voters of Dallas.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
They would need to do that.
Yeah, that's why I think the public, it's important that the public be aware of the status as well.
Right.
And we have to vote on that.
And I think it's also, when we talk about funding, you know, funding can be thought of as, do I have enough money to pay for lunch today, or do I have, you know, money for, you know, unborn children's education 25 years down the road, and it can be used either way. So I think we should be careful to say that we don't have a short-term or medium-term solvency or liquidity issue. What we've identified today is a medium to long-term viability issue, so that, you know, people are able to prospectively look forward and gain confidence that monies that they would expect 10, 20, 30 years down the road that we're financially viable to do that. I think we all agree that that's really the status, not one of anything short or medium term from a liquidity or solvency standpoint.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. That's a good point.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Any campaign, communication campaigns needs two elements, powerful messaging, and just a bit of extension on that. You know, messaging has to include accurate facts. It absolutely needs to be accurate. But it also needs to tap into people's beliefs, emotions, and actions. Because ultimately, facts are very important, but people make decisions oftentimes based on how they feel. How does it make them feel good? Is it connected to some higher purpose? So the messaging that we're going to go through is a platform to not just share the facts, some of which are very stark, but to try to paint a picture of how decisions today can actually create a brighter future for everybody going forward. And the other part would be the communication strategies to carry those messages to people who are needed, who we need to act and support the pension system. And you're seeing part one of that today, the messaging and how we got there. Right, could you go to 20? Just a real quick overview. I think Kelly mentioned this. This was a collaborative effort working with some board members and with Kelly and Josh as well to conduct this analysis and review and bring that information into a workshop, which we crafted into the messaging that you're about to see. 21. Again, some other things we looked at in interviews. I think it's worth noting that we spent at least an hour on the phone with Bill, Armando, Nick, and countless hours on the phone with Josh and Kelly to make sure we not only understood the facts of the situation, but also understood the higher purposes behind a successful funding of the pension system and what it would mean for the city of Dallas. 22. Now I'll turn it over to Lewis. I think Lewis is the first time. This is the first time many of you have heard from Lewis. Lewis is our senior creative director, and he's the one who takes and puts down in words all of the workshop material that we worked through a couple of months ago. So with that introduction, Lewis will take us to the next through several slides.
Thanks, Nick. So the first thing we want to review really are the four key themes that emerge from our discussions and our workshop, and I'll briefly go through those before we get into the actual messaging. The first key theme was that people think the problem has gone away, right? So, you know, what we heard is it's a problem postponed but not solved, knowing that council members certainly have pressing short-term priorities, but we want to urge them to consider the longer-term needs of the pension. And finally, that the legislature is requiring us to do something by 2024, or as we were told, either refix it or they will. The second key theme that emerged was it's our job to reassure people. So first responders, certainly, that they'll get their pensions. Tell them that we're also committed to honoring our promises to them, urging the city to not require them to contribute anymore. And finally, to believe that the comprehensive compensation system, including a healthy pension, is an important part of a safer, more secure city, which is a theme you'll hear in a few minutes. The third major theme was, go ahead.
Isn't it going to be hard for us to reassure? We don't have any control over implementing this. It's the city that has the control. So, I mean, I don't think we want to go out and promise or reassure people beyond what control we have on this. So, I mean, I think it's clear that it's the city that does this.
Correct. And part of that reassurance is that we want to let them know that we are committed to honoring our promises, the things that we have set forth. So from our perspective, that is our reassurance. And absolutely, I mean, there are things not in our control as well. But that was a theme we heard. Third is unity and trust. That our messaging should really start with us, but then it has to build trust outward to other groups. And of course, the biggest improvement since 2017. We built that unity and trust among the mayor's appointees and members' appointees on the board. But to make the key point that we can't win unless we make everyone an ally. And finally, the fourth key theme was this idea to educate, the need to educate. We certainly improved governance. There is no plan B. We need to let people know that doing nothing is not an option. Third, that we need to convince council they're putting good money after good money. And finally, we need to tell them that that we learned that we need to talk to everyone, people, businesses, and city officials around the city as well, something you guys mentioned just a few minutes earlier. Next slide, please.
We don't have a plan B, but under the legislation, it requires the independent actuary to recommend either more benefit cuts or more contributions somehow, some way. I mean, that's really
correct.
The only thing they can do. So people should be aware
that is
a plan B, but a distasteful one.
It's not a good one. Correct. Well put. Next slide, please. So very briefly, let me tell you what you're about to see. There are four key things that we're going to show about messaging. And as Dick mentioned, messaging is all about finding the right words, the right language, and certainly the right tone that we want to set as we communicate our actions going forward, not only to the council, but to voters, the media, and we'll go through all the different audiences in a few minutes as well. So four things we're going to look at. The first is what we call a manifesto. It is a sort of an inspirational expression of what we believe. It's written as a speech. It has the kind of language and tone we want to set for everything we'll do. So we'll look at that first. The second thing we'll see is what we call a value statement. That's just a fancy way of saying it's a very succinct expression of, you know, what is the greatest value of a healthy pension and what does that mean to all of the audiences that we'll be communicating to. The third is called messaging architecture, and all that is a one-page sort of synopsis, almost our dogma of the language we'll use. It'll have our value statement on it, and it'll have also some pillars or what we call reasons to believe what we're saying, and we'll go through that in a few minutes as well. And it sort of sets, again, the overall tone of the more detailed messaging we'll get in the next step in the process. And finally, we'll look at audience messaging. And I believe we have five different audiences we'll look at, and we'll give you a taste of the kind of tone and messaging we want to use when we address each of them, from the mayor and the council, certainly to our retirees, also to the news media and business people around the city. So we'll go over that in a few minutes. So let's go to the next slide, and we will start with the manifesto. And since it is a speech, I will read it as such. So it goes like this. Great cities are built on optimism and opportunity, but they're secured by service and sacrifice, by men and women who put their neighbors and community first, who put commitment and devotion first, who are willing to be there first. No wonder we call them first responders, our firefighters and police. And while they tirelessly secure our futures, they put their trust in others to secure theirs. But that trust was shaken. Their pensions were built on a weak foundation. So now they're faced with a dilemma and tough questions. Who can they trust now to make their pensions viable? Who will step forward with commitment and devotion? Who will be there first for them? The answer is right here. It's all of us, city government, community leaders, business people, citizens. The right people at the right moment in time to do what's right for our first responders and ourselves. Not because we were responsible for what happened to the pension, but because we are responsible for fixing it. For Dallas to be at its best, it must attract the best and be served by the best. Because great cities look ahead, not backwards. They create, build, reimagine, and rethink. They create optimism and opportunity, secured by the service and sacrifice of talented men and women, our first responders. They put us first. Now, let's do the same for them. So that sets the tone of what we want to be looking at in a moment. But it is meant to be factual, but also inspirational. And it puts a stake in the ground for how we view the task ahead. Okay, next slide, please.
The only one I would add in the first one is some reference to keeping the community safe. Public safety is a big issue, and tying in public safety is important, I think.
I agree.
I agree. And we're going to touch on that a little bit in some of these other details as well. But that's certainly an excellent point, and it is driving all of this messaging. Next slide, please. So this is the value statement. And it is a little hint of that manifesto you just read, but ultimately it leads to the core value of why a healthy pension is important. So it goes like this. So they are our first responders, men and women who put commitment and devotion first, who put their community first. It's time to put them first, to give them a healthy, viable pension, ensuring they get the benefits they deserve for the service and sacrifice. And in doing so, help retain the valuable experience of our current professionals and attract the next generation of dedicated firefighters and police officers. The result, the country's finest first responders, the best in public safety, and the continued dynamic growth of our city. And that section in blue is the key to it. It is linked to, you know, the finest first responders that ensures the best in public safety. And when you have that kind of city and community, it continues to fuel the growth of a city like Dallas now and in the future. Next slide, please. So this is the messaging hierarchy. I know it probably looks very small on your screen, but we'll have copies of this for everyone. But this is that one pager I mentioned, and it's usually just that. It's a quick read. So at the top is that value proposition that I just mentioned, but also is a next section of why it matters, the value of a well-managed, well-funded police and fire pension. So why it matters is, first, existing professional first responders are confident in their futures and will stay with the departments longer, meaning the city retains experienced professionals. The second, talented, highly motivated young people will be incented to join because of the benefits that a great pension offers them. Next, the community is safer and more secure with the kind of professional police, firefighters, and small pension nurtures.
Can you speak into the – I can't hear you very well.
Mike, this kind of got muffled. Go back a second. Hold on.
Hang on. I'll switch the speaker. Is that better?
Yes. I couldn't hear very well what he was saying.
Okay. That might have been my headphones just cranked out for some reason. All right. Everybody can hear me now better?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Do I need to go through those four again? I don't know where I cut out, so I'll just...
You can start on talented, second bullet.
Okay. Yeah, the second bullet of why it matters and why a healthy pension matters is that talented, highly motivated young people will be incented to join because of the benefits that a great pension offers them. The third, the community is safer and more secure with the kind of professional police and fire departments that a strong pension nurtures. And finally, it sends a signal to people and businesses wanting to relocate to Dallas that our first responders are highly valued and incented to be the best in the country, protecting and serving a vibrant economy. So the reasons to believe that are four that we've identified from our workshop. The first is that we're creating an engaged and independent board. The current board includes independent professionals with deep knowledge of pension fund management. They're unified in purpose, collaborative, and willing to make the tough, smart decisions needed to solve the pension's problems. The second reason to believe is we're keeping open communications. The pension leadership and board are completely transparent with the city, community leaders, the media, members, and retirees. Fixing the pension calls for an unprecedented collaboration among many stakeholders, and only through open communications and candid discussions can permanent progress be made. The third reason to believe is we're aligning and improving assets. The board is continuing to align the pension's assets with its obligations to become sustainable. The board will continue to maximize the value of legacy assets when the best opportunities are found. And finally, the fourth reason to believe is that we're honoring our promises to members and retirees. The pension is still underfunded, and the solution will require a large infusion of dollars from the city. The current members and retirees are already contributing more and accepting less. We are committed to honoring our promises, urging the city to not ask them to contribute even more or accept reduced benefits. They've done their part. Now let's do ours. So those four things are sort of the underpinnings of everything we believe and what is driving our messaging. Okay. Next slide, please. So let's walk through very quickly the messaging, the key messaging to different audiences. So the first is the message to the mayor and council. It goes like this. The pension is a big challenge, but also a great opportunity to further maintain Dallas as the key economic driver for all of North Texas. We understand you didn't create this problem. We've worked hard to restore the health of the pension fund by bringing real governance, eliminating unsuitable assets, and being transparent. We've done so through greater unity and a real coalition among the pension board. Supporting the fund is putting good money after good money. It's an investment in greater public safety that will attract and retain quality first responders. So that's a key message to the mayor. Now, to a different audience, to community and business leaders, we'd say, supporting the pension is good for our public safety, good for continuing to build a city that attracts dynamic companies, and good for our first responders. The Dallas economy is a model for the rest of the country. Ensuring public safety is a pillar of the city's remarkable growth and vital to the quality of life that relocating companies expect. And to the
this
media,
is Mark.
Go ahead.
This is Mark Malvo. Just to have a comment on this. One, I want to preface this by saying that I think this is a great idea. This is something that I, you know, kind of pushed, wanted to happen in terms of the messaging. I think overall it's going very well. I do have an issue regarding the targeting to the community and the business leader, and maybe it's more of a macro issue. And to me, it looks like we really are focusing, which is, I understand that, we really are focusing obviously on the mayor and the council, but when we're talking about the community, I kind of wonder whether we are making it maybe too monolithic. There are a variety of communities in Dallas that have different interests and have a different vision of what they view in terms of public safety and the role of the pension. And particularly, I'm wondering whether this message gets to those communities, particularly African-American communities, Latino communities, where they're not necessarily, you know, being represented by the business leaders, but they are almost, I think, Dallas, if it's not, it's very close to a majority-minority city. And I'm concerned whether this message is probably focused on a very a more narrow path as opposed to a larger path in talking to the variety of communities that actually have possibly differing views than what I think, at least what I'm seeing, this message is. And I'd like to hear what you have to say or anybody else have any comments on that.
Hi, Mark. This is Dick. Let me respond with three initial thoughts. First, we have, I think, six audiences that we've done very specific messages on here in this deck and worked on during the workshop. That does not mean we aren't going to have other audiences. I think we have five here. There's two more after what's on this slide. To make sure we were specific and thought about their needs and how they and issues that they would respond to, we provide that level of focus. We will, as we develop a program and start getting feedback on the communications that's going out, adapt messaging and tactics appropriately. You know, it's just like any plan, what's the old saying? No battle plan survives. You know, the first assault from the enemy. Everything has to be fluid. Everything has to be responsive to what the stakeholders we want to reach are saying. The third thing is that when we get to an overview of the communications framework, one of the tactics that we want to consider for the overall plan is community meetings and community engagement. Don't know what that looks like right now, but we have a mechanism to make sure this isn't somebody from the pension system or the city or a business-to-business leader talking with individual and discrete communities who have their own needs and points of view and telling them what's coming, and they ought to be happy about it. It's to get input so future communications can be shaped going forward. That's not the complete answer, and it certainly needs more discussion. But is that helpful at all, Mark?
Yes. No, that does. I just want to make clear that when we use the word to community and business leaders, that community thing, from what I'm hearing, and I understand we're at a higher level, so it's a bit anodyne, but that community thing is, I just really want to make sure that we're not necessarily, this target that we're trying to get is really too narrow a target, and right off the bat, we're not hitting communities that, you know, this message may be missing the target. That's all I have to say.
That's very well said. Thank you for that input.
Great. Thanks as well. Our third audience is to the news media, and as we know, a very jaded bunch. So our language to them has to be candid and straightforward. So it goes like this. The current state of the Dallas police and fire pension has caused pain, confusion, and disappointment among our first responders and our community. It will be challenging to fix and a hard story to cover. But we'll pull back the curtain for you for a candid view of the process, even when the information is still uncertain or unclear. You'll see and hear everything so you can better understand it all. We have nothing to hide, only a desire to get to a sustainable, fair solution. Next slide, please. Now, to key members of the legislature, we'd like to say, Dallas has some difficult decisions to make to get the police and fire pension fund into a viable position. We're doing everything we can to find a solution. And while all parties involved here in the city will work together, we need your help and agreement on our solution. Texas leads America in so many ways, and Dallas is a key part of that reputation. To keep the city strong, we need a strong pension system that will attract and retain quality firefighters and police officers. Together, Dallas will fix it, so you won't have to. Finally, to the members and retirees, there's a hard fight ahead to get to a viable, well-funded pension, and we will solve the problem working with the city. We're committed to honoring our promises, urging the city to not have you contribute any more or accept reduced benefits. You sacrificed enough already to help. You've done your part, and we want to restore your confidence in the financial stability of the pension fund and in receiving your lifetime benefits. You've given your all to Dallas, and now the city is going to do the same for you. So that is a key message to the members and retirees. So those five groups, and as Dick said, those are our first five, our key five. You see how the tone is slightly different, the language and the words we use. But going back to that manifesto, I think there is a sense of purpose and optimism also that comes through all of them. And again, that sort of straightforward, candid approach, we think, which is very, very important. All right, next slide, please.
So if we have this as our as the basis of our messaging, not complete for every audience, but as the basis of our messaging, we now have the opportunity to create a communications program that spreads that information and that point of view in an effort to gain support over the next years as we come to some key dates that the pension board is facing. The first is PR. And broadly, you know, we're thinking primarily public relations and media relations, that we actually put a program together that speaks out first and not in response to somebody else who may have another idea. Y'all will recall that in 2016, somebody else came up with a full-baked agenda on how to solve the problem. And so for many months, the pension system was scrambling back to reassert what would be a more appropriate agenda. We'd like to get out earlier and lead the discussion in media rather than respond to somebody else's leadership in that area. In today's world, social and digital is where people get their news. We want to make sure that the content that comes out from this program is representative of the values of the pension system, the benefits that first responders provide to the community, and provide an emotional connection to the individuals who are out there protecting the city. As Mark mentioned earlier, no communications program can be a monolith. It actually has to reflect the people it's tr-
trying to reach. And so we would want to put in place some mechanism of community events / community engagement where we get feedback and build consensus with a broad range of community members, each of which have their own different points of view. Paid, we're not talking about creating a huge paid advertising campaign, but to drive attention to social platform and our work at PR and community events, these days there has to be some element of promoted content that gathers attention, gathers eyeballs. We can't just rely on all the content gathering attention in a viral nature. So the good news is we think it's going to require some paid, but that's very efficient dollars that can be highly targeted to individual communities around specific issues with specific messages. Go to 30. And overall, we want to magnify how the decisions that are being made right now are going to affect the quality of life for the entire community forever. What that means for each individual member of the community is going to be somewhat different, but each of them is going to have a vision that's emotionally based that we want to connect to. That, yes, there's math involved, and the math matters, but the real driver behind what is trying to be accomplished by the pension system to shore up the economic status of the pension system is to improve the quality of life for everybody from a public safety standpoint and an economic standpoint. So we want to take the community on a journey that taps into that emotion by exposing them to the notion based on our point of view, engaging them to find out what their point of view is, and then work together to influence them to actually act and support a unified recommendation between the city and the pension board that the legislature can agree on. If you go to one more slide, there are a long list of tools that we need to consider to fit into that framework, to reach into the community, gather feedback, generate an emotional connection, and reach consensus. The next step is to take this messaging content, develop an integrated plan using the tools that you see here over a period of time in an effective way that can actually help us influence and build support for additional funding for the pension system. When I talked to this group last time, I think the initial proposal was to do part one and do part two for approximately $60,000. Well, we've done part one, and I think we came right in at $25,000. So what we would recommend now is to take this messaging, and I would gather some colleagues together across different disciplines. Again, continuing to work with representatives of the board and the leadership of the pension system to create that operational communications campaign to allow the pension system to set the agenda and drive the discussion as the city and the pension system works to a permanent solution. Happy to answer questions or get any kind of feedback. Let me first ask Kelly or Josh, is there anything I left out that you wish I would have mentioned?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Didn't hear the question.
He asked if there's anything else that he's missed.
Oh, no. I think you covered the presentation. Are there questions from the board?
I think just maybe a little bit more clarity on what the calendar would look like relative to next steps and when you would see us starting to create touch points outside of this plan. Are we talking about starting some of these external engagement points weeks, months, multiple quarter, some sense of that, what the calendar might look like?
Yeah, I'm happy. I've actually got our initial proposal that we submitted. It's not, I don't know if it's in the final one, but I pulled that up specifically so we could pull that out. The work that we just did, puts us in a really good position to actually develop that long-term plan over the course of the next 60 days. And given where we are in the calendar, it seems like we would have a really good opportunity to have a launch of whatever that program is, in January. Of course, that's if I ruled the world. Certainly can be flexible.
This is a lot of information, and I think the messaging is very broad. I'm just going to say it out loud. I think that it's not really clear who the audience is. I think that we are representing police and fire. I think this should be directed to the community of Dallas along with the city of Dallas. And I think it should be a little bit more targeted. I think that it should be a little bit more biased about pulling on the heartstrings of this community about how, you know, police and fire has been supportive. I just, if there's a tagline, I don't know what that is. It's like, we help, so can you help? I'm not really sure what this is. I really feel like it should be a little bit more, I don't know, to your earlier point, if it's going to pull at heartstrings. And yes, to me, the biggest arching issue is that people think this problem has been solved. It is nowhere near being solved. And I really think that needs to be underscored. And I also think that it's not the police and fire that's going to give up. It's going to be the community that needs to help, and it needs to be the city of Dallas that needs to be helped. I feel like that has to have more delineation than what this is right now. That's my initial impression. But then again, this is the first time I'm hearing at it. I'm listening and I'm looking at it, but that's just my initial impression. I don't think you can be everything to anyone, and I think it's it has to be an outreach to the varying types of communities that we have. It has to be, I mean, that's, what is the purpose of this, of this campaign, right? What is the purpose of this campaign?
It's to create long-term viability.
For the pension.
For the pension, yeah.
For the purpose of police and fire. So
well, of course, I mean, it's the police and fire, you have to believe that that's a fundamental part of a positive community, and that we clearly have really appeal in terms of a long-term viability of the plan, and that the longer we wait, the bigger the problem and the more risk associated with it there is, and that in our job of being good stewards of this plan, we're taking raising it to an issue where it's not an immediate liquidity issue, but it is a long-term liability issue. And I think you're correctly flagging that's hard to do because you don't have, it's not raining today. It's not, you don't have that immediate stimuli that's saying, hey, there's a problem. But what you want to do, maybe you create it similar to what we had with the power situation. We want to go ahead and fix the grid before the stress event occurs, where half the city's out of power for a week in an ice storm.
But I think, and again, this is just brainstorming right now. My initial impression is that the messaging in itself can be inferred that we are supporting our fire and police by showing their perspective. I think it's kind of really hard to also kind of lump in their kind of, we need to also appeal to them as well. Aren't we representing them? So therefore, that should be a little bit kind of put to the side, and it should be more about like, yes, this is about them. My point is I think it's like you're trying to represent police and fire, the city of Dallas, and the community, who have all been had these already preconceived notions. I think not recognizing the brouhaha that it was last time, that we should learn from the way the media took storm of that and kind of readdress it. Because they're going to say, okay, so what happened? What really did happen? Like, is that problem solved? What problem was really solved? What are we solving now? I think that's not very clear. I'm not saying that we can do that. I'm just saying this is big.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that is there, I mean, the mayor clearly has recognized the problem.
Right.
And he's asked a group of people to look at solutions. I think the problem, as he sees it, is that selling those solutions, there are a variety of them, to the city council and to get the support of the public to support them and push the city council
exactly.
to approve
exactly.
it. So that's really where
that's
we need to solve
so
it.
So why is that not his messaging more directed that way? That's exactly what I'm saying. That is, I don't hear that here. I hear that is exactly what I'd like that to be more directed towards
yep.
than kind of like with community.
Yeah, the community clear.
City of Dallas, and by like letting this messaging be almost a voice of the police and fire to those audiences.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Not kind of saying, okay, we don't want confidence with our fire police because we want to make sure that they know that there's a place to find a job and stay here because we're looking out for their long term. I think that's kind of like union. I don't. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's just too much.
I mean, I think you're sort of saying we need public safety, and in order to do that, we need to retain and hire qualified people. And
but
the only way we're going to do that is fund the pension plan.
Right, but that, to me, is a little bit noise, because what you're saying is that's not going to happen if we don't get the community understanding of their position. They've already done a lot. And if you're telling us that there's only one of two options, that the city comes or we have to cut more benefits, that's a very, very serious thing, and I don't think that latter part is what we want to consider. So if we're really, really, if this messaging should be about the first part, then let it be about the first part.
Yep, I agree. I mean, I think that's the really only option is getting more contributions from the city by them doing something dramatic.
Right.
And that's
so
where the support's going to have to be.
If people are going to vote, if it's not going to go before, and people are going to, if this is going to come to a vote, shouldn't we really be talking to the people who are going to really be the ones that are going to influence change?
I think that's why on slide 27 and 28, they kind of separate the different audiences, because in the end it needs to be the citizens, probably, that will have to vote. But to get something on the ballot and to get something that's viable, the mayor and council have to agree because they have to put it on the ballot. They have to support it or it's, you know, dead on arrival. The media has to understand in a way that it's supportive or it won't pass. And, you know, ideally the members would get behind it and be supportive as well. And we have a huge challenge there just because, I mean, you were at that meeting the other day that, you know, it's not going to be helpful if the members are all fighting with each other or
correct.
With us along the way. But I think that's why there's different we're all still trying place, but how you talk to the groups and what their role is different, and I think that's what they're trying
to
do.
But to me, it's like what the difference was last time when you had the mayor
right.
putting in injunctions and saying, no, this is going to stop, this is crazy, and it was very this way, and now you have a mayor that's saying, okay, no, okay, we're in this together kind of thing. That's kind of the messaging I think that's very different and stark from the last time. And it's very important to tell the community that it is, that Dallas also does recognize that we have to work together to solve this. That's a very different persona, tone, than it was not that long ago. 2017 was not that long ago. And people remember the negativity.
Right.
They remember saying, oh, my God, City of Dallas is going bankrupt. Oh, my God, you know, Mayor Rawlings created an injunction, and they're bad because they stole money. This, I would rather have this kind of like harmonious thing saying, yes, the governance is there. Things are changed. These guys have really done what they can. The new tranche of firefighters recognize what was fixed is that we put in those things that it can't happen again, but the funding was not fixed.
Right.
So that's what was fixed. What wasn't fixed? That's the delineation. What was fixed? What wasn't fixed? What was fixed was governance. You can't do that anymore. But what's not fixed is the funding. And to me, that is very important.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think a lot of this is about building the bridge from really the last thing that the citizens know is the fight in 2017.
Yes.
And then it's
it was so explosive that we need to build that bridge.
Yes.
From,
okay, the city was saying this was bad before, but now the new mayor is saying this is okay. How do we get from the last I knew to move all the way to where I would support this, which is a huge way to move, right?
Part of getting the citizens of the community, the people, the voters, is to see that there is some agreement, there's some commonality in what we're moving forward. And again, I think this needs to be directed to the community, to the city council, to those people that are actually going to affect change. I think there should be a delineation of what was fixed in response to the debacle and what we need going forward and what we need to, you know, support our first responders in this way. And that's kind of like, again, I'm kind of spewing this off the top of my head as I'm reacting to what I'm hearing, but that's kind of been my feeling of, let's really use what we saw grab headlines last time that stuck with our community, which was so misaligned. And now if we're more aligned, let's almost go and say that the messaging is not just us, it's maybe potentially the city of Dallas and us to the community. Because if we go and we say that we've done our part, who's not doing their part then? The question goes, who's not doing their part? Are we pitting ourselves again to the city? We've got to be careful about those things.
But I think it's premature to think the city's on board. The
mayor's
on board.
That's what I'm saying, though.
The mayor's on board, but the city administration and the city council aren't even really aware of this issue at this stage of the game. It's going to be something coming forward shortly. But
Tina, the way I look at it is that we have to start from a bedrock of trust and truth.
Agreed.
And that I always view, you know, a task like this is that it's so daunting when you think about what it takes to get to the finish line. But I sort of look at it when you have a target sheet where you have the red circle and the white and the red, and, you know, is that we have to start off, we're the inner circle, and I think we all can look each other in the eye and say we've developed a bedrock of trust and unity. Doesn't mean everyone sees the same on every issue, and if that in fact is true, and we have good data, we have a good plan, we have ability to work through conflict, then we can move to each concentric circle outside the middle bullseye, not knowing exactly what that's going to look like, but working with key business partners to develop a good plan. But, you know, my sampling of talking to people is that they want to trust. And so we really need to be the bedrock of trust and truth, and then be smart about working on a plan with a goal in mind. So we can't sit here today. And, you know, I think Mark made some great points. Along the way, we have to create a Pied Piper effect, and we have to deputize a lot of people. Okay, that's the way that things like this, you know, work. But we have to start somewhere, and I applaud, you know, I think Bill got this going, and the mayor, and I'm very much for taking this next step. You know, we need to make a motion on that if we want to go ahead and take step two and fund it. And it's great to see the engagement, but it starts with us.
Oh, I agree. I absolutely agree. I've been for this because, in fact, I misunderstood in some ways because I thought that we would have someone in a resource for when other things happen, for example, with when we get sued because of the, because of the issues of the widows and the COLA or whatever. And I kind of said we need kind of more communications and outreach to the community to explain these kind of situations. As far as this specifically is targeted for the future funding and viability of the pension, that is absolutely, absolutely important. I absolutely 100% agree. That's not the issue. The issue is on the messaging. Like whittling down really who's the audience and what we're really saying. For example, and there's a lot of little things that went along the way, like good money after good money. Who is that speaking to? What are you saying, and why should I trust that if I'm a Dallas, you know, taxpayer? These type of things. I know that we're not going to answer this. I know that. And I get this Pied Piper effect. But let's make sure who's doing the flute and who's following. I just want to make sure to that illusion that who's paying for this sponsor, you know, outreach, okay? We are, and why, and who do we need to follow? That's all I'm saying to that illusion. That's all I'm saying. It needs to be a little bit more whittled, I feel, and directed.
I think that, once again, there's a lot here, and I don't think anyone
would feel like
all things that need to be said are, you know, can be said right now, but I think that we are at a good juncture point to say, can we take step two? And if so, I think we have a specific motion or a specific recommendation from staff to go ahead and proceed with step two. What is the funding amount for that?
Well, I was going to ask Dick that question because I was a little bit confused. Going in today, I thought the next phase was $25,000 based on your email, but it sounds like I heard that it could be an extra $35,000. Will you clarify the budget for this next phase, Dick?
Yes, $35,000.
Okay. And what that will get us is a plan. So
That'll get you to an operational plan that's ready to launch.
But it won't get us, say, it'll tell us we need to place ads or we need to do this social media buy or we need to do whatever.
It will. The other thing it will have in it, reference something, I think it was Nick speaking a moment ago about starting with a bullseye. Sorry if I misrepresented what you said, Nick, and then stepping out. So when we say launch, there will be a measured launch starting at a point where we think we can generate maximum leverage and then move out from that center point to create a broader coalition over time, tailoring the messaging, tailoring the engagement tactics by what we know to be true of each audience as we know it now and as we learn it going forward. So the goal would be to have a launch, a communications program, including a way to roll it out for maximum effectiveness by audience, by tactic.
Okay, so can we go ahead, would someone be willing to make a motion and go ahead?
Can I ask a question first for Kelly? This is Ken. It's just a quick question. When is the mayor's committee completed as far as their recommendation goes to what needs to be done?
Let me try to answer. I mean, we have met with the mayor very recently and have submitted our initial set of recommendations. He's asked us to do some further due diligence on a number of those. And we're hoping to, we're hoping to do that and by the end of October, I would think.
Can I ask you a question?
Okay.
What's been the level of the city manager's engagement in
process? Zero.
Zero?
The city manager per se, we have worked closely with the city attorney, the city CFO, and their staff on a number of these issues.
Okay, so you have done the city CFO? And
yes.
All those. Okay.
Yes, we've been working with Elizabeth and Sherry and Chris Queso, et cetera. But I have not seen the city manager at all in any of these, but I'm not surprised at that.
And one final question, this one's for Dick. Depending on what the recommendation is, I'm sure there's going to be a different strategy for each. And to me, just saying if it's going to be POBs versus a tax, to me, one's more easy to market than the other. Is there going to be a cost difference depending on the recommendation that's going to come out of the mayor's committee?
That's a really good question, and I would just be making up an answer to that. But I think that's a critical thing to make sure we have incorporated into the program and into the plan.
Okay. I just didn't want to get blindsided last minute.
This is exactly what you were asking, but also ongoing funding for execution is going to be important as well. And that's a critical part of the planning process. We clearly know we can't run this like a statewide campaign in California, that every dollar that that you have available is already spoken for several times over. So we are going to be very diligent in making sure that we come up with a program that's not just going to be effective, but it's going to be effective given a proper stewardship of the resources that you are managing.
Great. Okay, that's all I got. Thanks, Dick and Bill.
Again, any messaging that starts to educate the public that there is something looming, I'm all for it. So, you know, I'd love to see the plan.
So this recommended motion would need to change to not
35. Change to 35,000, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, would someone like to make the motion?
I'll make the motion.
Tina does it with zealousness. do we have a second?
Second.
Mondo, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. I will add that I just visited, just as a means of introduction, with both the chiefs of the fire and police department recently, just to sort of, you know, check in and those sorts of things. And I did flag that these types of discussions and undertakings are underway. And it was very general, very preliminary. But
what did they say?
You know, just all, you know, very positive. And Chief Garcia actually has dealt with pension issues in his prior job in San Jose. So he was aware of what the dance card looks like, you know, to a certain extent. And then Chief Artis and his team, who, you know, there's a lot of longevity in the city of Dallas. You know, they're very aware of where things have been and where they're going. And there was a ton of positivity. And, you know, the big theme is trust. You know, people want to trust. They want to be told the truth. And that, to me, is, you know, kind of the raw material for moving forward. You need other things in addition to that. You need to build on it, but we can't get this done without it. And that's why I think the great efforts of staff, and then I think that the unity we've shown as a board over several years, you know, and Bill really, I think, helped start that.
And that we have control over as far as messaging goes. And maybe as we all see our unity and trust within each other, that be where we don't have to get the buy-in from that, from the city of Dallas, and that this speaks in itself.
Yeah.
The hard work and everything that we put in.
But what it doesn't mean is that we all necessarily agree on everything and see everything the same way.
That's the point.
That's why we have different, you know, constituencies and different people that are able to raise perspectives that you know.
But that's the point.
Yeah.
Nor do we have the authority to make it happen.
Okay. Josh?
Dick and Lewis, thank you. You guys can drop off.
Thank you so very much. Thank you all
thank
for your
you.
Time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So HB 3898, we've kind of postponed this discussion 1 or 2 months, so we could have an opportunity to talk with the PRB about their views on it a little more. So basically what the bill says, a lot of things, but really the important aspects with respect to us are the provisions that require that the pension, that any pension system and the sponsoring city of the plan enter into a funding soundness restoration plan if they get an actual evaluation that shows that they're more to 3 years in a row that shows they're more than 30 years to fund. And so, if they don't do the evaluation every year, but that's not what we do. The PRB initially had thought, I guess when the bill started, that provision was going to be just going forward, a prospective type of provision. The language in the statute, however, is not prospective, and I think in our conversations with the PRB, they've acknowledged that that's the case. The PRB does have rulemaking authority under the bill to sort of implement how it's supposed to work. But I would say that after sort of these conversations with the PRB and looking at the bill again and looking at our statute again, I think my conclusion is that there's really no action item. I mean, we are, when the valuation is finally issued, whenever that's going to be within the next month or so, it's going to show that we will have exceeded 30 years to fund for three straight years. So technically, we would be within this statute, and we would be required to come up with a funding soundness restoration plan together with the City of Dallas, which requires you to become actuarially funded within 30 years. But the provision that I think is important is that plan requirement occurs the later of 2 years after the last year, the third year where you're more than 30 years to fund, or September 1st, 2025. And I think that means that the way our statute works, and I think this is a good thing to discuss after what we talked about the item previous, the way the statute works and the fact that in 2024 the PRB, and we've discussed this many times, the PRB appoints an actuary, they look at the plan, and then the board's required to come up with plan changes that make sure that we do comply with the requirement, the funding requirements, which is now 30 years under Government Code Section 802, and then ultimately concludes with potentially a bill out of the legislature in for the 2025 session. In my view, I don't think that there's any extraordinary action that would be required of the board. I think that we will likely or potentially be on a PRB list to say that, you know, we're under this section and that some funding soundness restoration plan may be required. It may not be required. I think we'll have further conversations with the PRB. They understand where our situation is, and so maybe they were on a list with an asterisk. Maybe we're not on a list. I can't really guarantee what's going to happen. But from my perspective, I think the actions we were just talking about, working with the city, trying to get, you know, get a funding fix, I think that's just, you know, proceeds apace. And I don't think that the statute, in my view, as it interacts with 6243A-1, requires any extraordinary action on the part of the board or the pension system or the city for that matter.
Is this a law that passed, or is this so that
yes.
it passed in the last session?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so, you know, there was a question, I guess, that's been kicking around and raised, and I'll just address it. You know, I don't think that there's a grandfather provision that says if you're already under a funding soundness restoration plan, then it might be a 40-year requirement rather than a 30-year requirement. In my view, the provisions in our bill are not exactly like a funding soundness restoration plan. They're similar, but they're not exactly the same because it's a different procedure. The board's got authority to make rules, and then ultimately the legislature steps in. I mean, this is how we formulated it back in 2016 and 17. And so I don't think that we are grandfathered in and that there's a 30-year requirement and that ultimately we'll be required to reach a plan that gets us to 30 years funding at the end of 2025, if not September 2025, if not earlier. So others may take a different view. Certainly that's how the world goes round. That's why the world goes round. But in my view, I don't think that we are grandfathered in, and so we've got a 30-year requirement.
I would say whether we're grandfathered or not, I would think that this board should be pushing to get a 30-year funding status. The sooner we can get it, I'd like the 20-year funding status, but we should be pushing for at least 30.
Yeah, it's another catalyst that is something real, and it's there for a reason, and something that should just be another one of those things that's out there that we need to be mindful of as we proceed with the plan to properly fund. And that's what this legislation is about, is about ensuring long-term financial soundness. And so we concur with that big thought.
Yeah, to your point, to Bill's point, all the road signs point this direction, right? And it's incumbent upon this board to read the road signs and say, this is the path we're on, and just keep pushing along that path. I don't think that we should just go, this isn't a big deal. No, we need to be aware of it, put it, you know, on our plate, action item, and move forward with it.
We're not exempt.
maybe that Adopt a Mile program would bring a couple people in to help us. Okay. Next, Josh and Kelly about possibly rescheduling the October board meeting.
So we are, and we'll talk about this a little more in closed session, but we are we're still scheduled for a month-long trial in the case we have against the Townsend Group and Gary Lawson starting October 4th. So that would mean that either Kelly or I or both of us will be in trial on the date of the board meeting, the second Thursday, I think that's the 14th. And so I think we, you know, and there is a possibility that the trial may not go because the Dallas County may, Dallas County judges may decide not to hold trials, especially a month-long trial. So we're still, we're preparing, and the lawyers are working very hard, but it's a possibility it may get called off. But for now, we're assuming that it might happen. So I think if it does actually go forward, we are proposing to sort of check with the board members, and, you know, we're looking, targeting potentially like the Friday after the board meeting rather than the Thursday, because the judge's her policy is to really not hold trials on Fridays, and she holds hearings and other things and matters that she's, that, which are obviously a lot of them that they've got going. So that's what we would target, is the Friday after the board meeting. Obviously, we'll check with trustees' schedules and see if we, if that works best for everybody. But for the most part, the days of the week, other than that, will be filled with trial attendance by one or both of us, and possible trial testimony by one or both of us. So
you're talking about the 15th instead of the 14th, then?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, I would sort of move us that let's go ahead and do it if you think that there's, it's pretty likely that the 14th is a conflict, and sort of serve up, does anyone have an issue, and let's go ahead and lock it in just because of people's schedules. So does anyone have a conflict with the 15th, or do they need some time to check on things?
I'm going to have to call on either date, so it wouldn't matter.
Okay. So let's go ahead and move it to the 15th at 8:30.
Last year's audit completed.
Yes, that was it. We are working ahead as much as we can on the audited financials, completing schedules, working on the annual report, so that we'll be ready to complete those when we have the final piece of information. Any questions? Thank you. Nick?
Sure. Kelly?
So this is your September monthly contribution report, which is based on July data. The trend still continues, which is positive for us.
What page is that on?
That is on page...
Okay, 56. Yeah.
During this, in July, there was two pay periods, and there was 149 fewer employees on the payroll than the hiring plan. And this isn't working. John, can you go to the next page? You'll see that on the top line there that for the month we had, as I said, two payrolls. The comp pay was 97% of the floor and 105% of the hiring plan. So even though they're below by 149 individuals because of the raises that they've put in place, they're exceeding the hiring plan estimates. And since HB 3158 was effective, we're at 93% of the floor and 101% of the hiring plan. So things are, as they have been for the last few months, looking good. Any questions on that? Okay. If I could move on to the next item, is that
yes.
Okay? The next item is your monthly approval of trustee education and travel. I haven't received any requests from any trustees that want to attend anything at this point. There's two classes, OPAL classes listed here. If you'd like to attend either of those or add anything to the list, we can make a motion today. Otherwise, we don't need a motion on this item.
Yeah, the only thing I would say here is that as we move into this next step of the communication plan, I think it's not an issue with staff, but I think with us on the board, we all need to be comfortable that we can speak coherently to the basic issues of the funding status and those types of things that you'll be peppered with by people external as we try to build the credibility going forward. So that may be some enhanced teach-ins here in board meetings on some things on the actuarial side of it, like when we say that we're not 30 years funded, we want to get to 20, that everyone sort of coherently understands, at least in general, what that means, how you get there, and so on. So I just sort of flag that as something that when we do start to be external on this, everyone needs to have, I think, a base level of confidence on these sort of key statistics.
Be aware of what not to speak definitively about. Sometimes in these discussions, the things that get said that stick really vigorously, and so we need to avoid the things to say with any degree of certainty in that process. Trust me when I say it's a thing.
Got it. Okay, now we're going to segue to really good news. Ryan's going to give us a portfolio update.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it. Good morning, everyone. So we're on page 66 for the portfolio update, and the good news is that we got $59 million in proceeds back in August from the sale of two large Dallas area real estate investments. I provided a page in the additional confidential material that outlines kind of what those two assets were and results and returns on those. So that's out there for you guys to look at. If you want to go into a little bit more detail on it, we can. But I guess along with that, the monetization of those private market assets and transition into the productive liquid portfolio is the top focus for us. We're at 136 year-to-date in private market distributions. We took that $60 million and rebalanced into the liquid portfolio, net $20 million each into global equity, EM equity, and EM debt. And I'll show you in a second kind of how we went about doing that. But that accomplished the initial funding to the U.S. small cap manager, Eastern Shore. We funded them up with about half of their projected long-term allocation. And then on the international small cap search, we plan to take our sixth RFP candidate to the IAC in September 23rd to get approval and then issue that RFP shortly thereafter. So the liquid portfolio year to date is performing well. We're up 10% as compared to 8.3% for a 60-40 benchmark. Keto will cover performance in a bit more detail, but happy with how that 70% of the portfolio has been performing this year. So looking at the asset allocation and the rebalancing detail, what I did on this page on 68 now is showed where we're at post-rebalancing actions and outlined how we went about doing it. So we pulled $10 million each from two of the equity managers, Manulife and Walter Scott, to more equally rebalance the four active global equity managers. And then we took $20 million of new money, along with that $20 to fund the $40 million to Eastern Shore. And then we funded another $20 million each into RBC and EM Equity and $20 million into Ashmore and EM Debt. A few other points here. The 809, you can see the post-rebalancing amount in global equity that compared to $506 million pre-COVID drawdown to February of 2020. So we're $300 million more into the public equity at this point. And then at the private market assets, we're at 28% right now. That compares to 41% in private markets a year ago. Looking at the asset allocation, the plan with the updated allocation was to equally rebalance into EM equity, EM debt, and global equity until we reach those new targets, 5% in EM equity and 4% in EM debt. We have about another $10 million each to go rebalancing-wise to get to target in EM equity and debt, and then the rest of the money would be going into global equity until we get up to target there. Looking at the initiatives on 71, mentioned the international small cap search. I expect that to potentially wind down or get to a recommendation in Q4 early 2022. We also plan to take the global equity structure review to the IAC in September and bring that back to the board in October for you guys to review. And that outlines how we're going to allocate to that 55% higher allocation into public equity. And looking at the investment review plan, I'm going to hand it over to Mike here in a second to provide a high-level review of how we're allocating to fixed income and a high level of the managers there. And then we'll come back next month with equity, public equity, and then private equity and debt review in November. So any questions for me before I hand it over to Mike?
Yeah, I would like to just make an observation so that everyone kind of sees what I'm seeing, and if anyone sees it differently, to point out. The big picture here is that, you know, we had a basket of investments that were illiquid and we felt like unsuitable for a pension fund, and that was sort of what we came into several years ago. Staff has done, I think, a great job of monetizing those assets, salvaging the best values, and creating the best values that we could. And several of these were done at a profit, and many were done at a loss. And that at the same time, recognizing that fragility that we came into, we created this concept of the safety reserve, which truly is the equivalent of kind of asset allocation martial law, where you know you're agreeing to take a big pool of capital and not compound a return on it, but instead to have it as a buffer for funding needs. And that is not a way to run a pension long term, but we all felt that was short term a necessary step. So a sign of health is that we are now reducing that safety reserve. And another sign of good health is that we've dramatically increased the amount of our investable dollars that are in the public markets that are in suitable investments for a pension fund like this. So hopefully what we're trying to do, first of all, is produce long-term financial viability and compound at a good rate of return. But we have a lot of different pulleys and gears that are at work achieving that process, and they all interconnect. So we're reducing the safety reserve. We're monetizing out of these illiquid, non-suitable assets that we've been in, and we're increasing the percentage in the long-term allocation that we think makes sense for a pension like this. And that's really, you know, several years worth of work, and this is, you know, you look at it on a snapshot basis, but it's important to see the process in terms of where it's come from and where it's going. So I just always think it's important to understand we're talking about what's happening, but to talk about the why and why it's the right thing to do, it's always good to mention it in context of the bigger picture. So I just wanted to flag that for everybody.
Okay. And it will be a few more years going forward to get all the way out of the legacy assets. Yes? Over to you, Mike.
Great.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you for this. Yeah, you should be able to
hold on.
Click hard.
All right, got it. Great. So, Mike, I'm going to go over the public fixed income portfolio pretty quickly at a high level. We got Makita right after this. That'll dive deeper into performance, but we do welcome any questions that anybody has. So we'll be on slide 75 to start. So here on the top, we've got kind of a graph, and then the bottom's the table of the overall fixed income allocation. A couple key points here. We're currently at 27.5% of DPFP's portfolios in fixed income, with a target of 25%. We're mainly at target with most of the individual allocations. Short-term investment-grade bonds, as we mentioned earlier, is a little over-allocated due to us drawing down that safety reserve this year. That should be reduced to target by the end of the year. And then emerging markets debt, we're currently underweight a little bit, and that will be increased to target by the end of the year as well. This next slide.
Just on the mic on that.
Yeah.
The short-term investment-grade bonds is 3 points above the target, but that's what we're working down by year-end?
Yeah.
Okay. We are going to rebalance it back to target then.
Yeah, we're taking $15 million out a month
until
December.
You.
This next slide shows the fixed income portfolio kind of milestones that we've had. Shows that there's been a lot of evolution in the last 5 years in the portfolio, and this just kind of recaps all those milestones. A key point to take here is that we'll be at the new targets set in the allocation by the end of the year. Here, this next slide shows the performance on the top of the whole entire DPFP fixed income portfolio, and then the bottom shows portfolio metrics for each individual manager and the portfolio as a whole. 2 points to mention on the top is that we're beating the benchmark in fixed income for most trailing periods with and without IRM, the short-term investment grade bond allocation. We show it without that short-term investment grade bond allocation in the second line just because it's such a big portion of our fixed income allocation. So you can see the returns between both of those. This bottom table, I just want to show kind of each asset class and manager and some of their characteristics.
you can see in the first two lines on that bottom table, you know, going from left to right, we're going to have the least risky investments on the left with our short-term investment grade, and then getting riskier as you go to the right all the way to EM debt. And you can see that with the yield and maturity getting higher as we go to the right, and the average quality, credit quality of the portfolio getting lower as we go to the right. And then I want to highlight that bottom line, the duration, average duration. You can see that the two investments that we have that have higher sensitivity to interest rates, which is measured by duration, is Longfellow and Ashmore, the investment grade and emerging market debt investment. And then here on the right, I just want to highlight the overall DPFP fixed income portfolio versus the benchmark. So we do have a higher yield than the benchmark, a slightly lower credit quality, and then the duration and weighted average maturity of our portfolio is significantly lower than the benchmark, but that's mainly due to the larger safety reserve that we have in our short-term investment-grade bonds.
Is the Longfellow duration longer than you would expect? I thought they were more of a short-duration person.
No, so they do not so they're benchmarked to the U.S. Ag, and they don't really play too much in duration. They'll go 10 to, like, plus 10% or minus 10%.
They're right around there then?
Yeah, so they'll stick close to the duration of the U.S. Ag.
A lot of fixed income managers are on the shorter end of the duration curve.
Yeah, I think they're shorter by as much as they're allowed in the mandate, but they're not taking duration bets really in that portfolio.
Yeah,
Mike, these characteristics are at June 30, correct?
Yeah.
So we would expect to have a little bit more yield, a little bit lower credit quality, and a little bit maybe higher maturity once we get to that full safety reserve reduction. So
yeah.
We'll show you a snapshot of that again once we get all the way down to the new target there.
Yep. Great. So to the next slide. So these next slides are going to be set up the same way. Two slides per manager, just kind of highlighting the philosophy, the process, the organization, and then the following slide will be performance expectations and performance. So here the first one is income research and management. It is the short-term investment grade investment that we've been talking about. It is part of the safety reserve. Just a reminder, this investment plus the cash allocation of 3% that we have should equate 18 months of cash outflows under the new target allocation. So this investment invests in short-term bonds with a maturity of 1 to 3 years. Everything is investment grade, so it's high credit quality, and they'll invest in U.S. Treasuries, corporate bonds, and securitized products. So with R&M, we expect modest returns with low volatility since it's the safest asset class after cash. They will outperform in market rallies and underperform in downturns. We can see this if you look at that second table, the max drawdown table. In March 20, R&M was down 1%-ish relative to the benchmark that was up a little bit. That's, you know, the drawdown is not relatively, you know, minor considering the rest of the market at that time. And then the highlight that I want to mention is that, you know, we were able to access R&M to draw funds to rebalance with zero liquidity issues in March of 20. So it's doing its job. Next manager is Longfellow. They're our investment-grade bond manager. So they are investing in the same type of assets that R&M invests in, except that they will also go and invest in bonds with longer dated maturities. So this is why they have that higher duration profile. With them, we expect a little bit higher yield than R&M and higher long-term returns than R&M just due to that extra risk factor.
The performance is going to be a little bit more volatile than R&M. You can see with the drawdown in March 20, negative 2% versus that negative 1% in R&M. So we funded this initially in July of 2020 and completed the funding throughout the rest of 2020, and we are at target now. Our next manager is Pacific Asset Management. They are our U.S. bank loans manager. So they will invest in corporate bank loans of U.S. companies that are non-investment grade, so they'll be higher yielding. Bank loans are obviously issued by banks, but unlike bonds, they have a floating interest rate payment. So what that means is that their interest rate sensitivity is going to be much lower relative to bonds. As far as the performance for Pacific, we expect them to outperform in down markets and underperform in up markets. This is due to the strategy being overweight larger and more liquid loans, so it's got a higher quality profile. We see this shown in March of 20 in that drawdown. They were only down 9.5% versus the benchmark that was down negative 13.5%, so they did protect on the downside during that. Our next manager is Loomis Sayles. They are our U.S. high-yield manager, so they invest in higher-yielding, non-investment-grade bonds of U.S. companies. So, again, these are different from the bank loans, as the bonds have fixed interest rates, and they are sensitive to duration. The key point with Loomis that I want to make is that we've been with them since 1998, but in 2020, we switched from the Loomis full discretion high yield product that we'd been with since 98 to a more U.S. high yield benchmark aware product. This occurred in December of 2020. This is a thought out process. We're holding monthly manager calls with the portfolio managers throughout last half of 19 and most of 2020. And we had multiple conversations with the IAC and kind of did a soft search just to compare what the other options were. This product, we don't have a lot of performance for yet, but it will have lower volatility relative to the high yield benchmark. This is a product of tightening the constraints on this product versus the previous one. The previous product was allowed 50% outside of the high yield benchmark, and this one is around 25% outside, so we should expect a lot more, a lot less volatility. Our last manager is Ashmore. They're our emerging markets debt manager. So they invest in a blended debt portfolio, which consists of emerging market government bonds, corporate bonds, and exchange rate products. The key point here is this is the only non-U.S. fixed income allocation that DPFP has. So it acts as a diversifier in terms of, duration being U.S.-based or foreign-based. The investment style is very deep value, and they will invest in distressed assets. So the performance is expected to be volatile, and they will underperform in down markets and outperform in up markets. We can see that here in the drawdown. You can see that in every drawdown they've underperformed. But just highlighting the most recent one, in March of 20, they underperformed by about 900 basis points. But since the bottom of that drawdown and in the recovery, they have outperformed about 12.5%. So they are performing as we would expect. And then in conclusion, I guess we've made significant progress on getting to target of our target allocation, and we'll be there at the end of the year. Overall, the DPFP public fixed income performance has been positive relative to the benchmark. There is a slide in Diligent with management fees for you guys to take a look at. It's high level. It's going to range from about 10 to 75 basis points based on the asset class. And DPFP does have an MFN on every investment in the company. Any questions?
Hey, this is Ken. I got one long question, I guess. And actually, Nick's response was kind of a good segue to it. Do we ever see ourselves involved in investing in cryptocurrency? And here's why I'm asking that question. I've had that same question asked to me by active member, by retiree, and, of course, by outside individuals. And not knowing much about how that works investment-wise, my response is a guess, and I tell them this is just a guess, that this is just too volatile for us at this point to get involved with. It's kind of like commodities. You can make a lot of money real quick, or you can lose a lot of money real quick, kind of like a Las Vegas dice game. So is my response to that kind of on point, or do I need to add more to that?
It's Ryan.
That's for anybody. That's for Ryan or anybody else who wants to chime in.
I don't think anytime soon. I mean, more companies are starting to put on their balance sheet. I think some institutions are starting to look at it. I don't think any public pensions have gone into that space yet, and people that are start going with, you know, baskets of currencies, and there's an incredible amount of risk and an incredible amount of volatility, not until after 2024.
I would say our whole goal is to become more on the fairway of investments and to be pretty typical and liquid and not speculative. Mm-hmm. And I would have a hard time if approving it because I don't know sure anybody understands it even.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say never, but no time soon. And, you know, we don't have gold in our portfolio, and a lot of people are using it as a replacement for gold.
I would say I've got another year's term. It won't be different from my term.
Okay. But is there any –
Mark Malville. We won't be doing crypto. I won't be voting for crypto anytime soon because I prefer if you have your risk are lower going to Las Vegas.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that was going to be my next question or statement. Is there anything out there education wise? And I don't want a marketing education. I just kind of want a general education that anybody knows of that can send me the information so that. Other than just saying it's like a Las Vegas dice game, I could say, well, you know, look at this, look at that, you know, whatever.
Leo, Aaron.
Hi, this is Leo. We at Nikia
have done
quite a bit of work, so I will forward to Ryan some white papers and analysis we've done. Overall, you know, the document doesn't really take a position you should or you should not, but it balances, you know, some pros and, you know, a lot of considerations, among which are very high volatility, regulatory uncertainty, and rapidly evolving technology and competitors. That said, I think it's a good set of papers. We'll forward those, and then if you have any follow-up questions, we can have a separate conversation.
No, that's great. I'm glad you're on the line. Thank you, Leo.
You're welcome.
Add something.
I was just going to say that El Salvador just accepted that Bitcoin as a good.
Was it Ecuador or El Salvador?
El Salvador did this week.
But they also had it taken offline already.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Although maybe we can do name, image, and likeness of Bill and sell that as a funding mechanism for the for our gap. But no, the crypto is interesting. The technology it sets on, the blockchain technology, is definitely here to stay. And crypto will play a role in our capital markets. But the thing you always, one of the first principles you have to go back to is the question of suitability. And right now, cryptocurrencies fail numerous ways on the suitability test for public pensions, and therefore, you know, we don't leave our wingman That's one of our things going forward. So it's not an appropriate investment today, but that being said, getting educated on it, understanding blockchain technology, I think is a very smart thing to do, Ken, and I tip my hat to you for asking.
Thank you.
As far as these asset class reviews go, we have a public equity one coming up next month, and we've been rethinking, you know, format, frequency, and forum, board, or IAC to take them to. So if you guys have any feedback on that, feel free to reach out to me or Kelly or give it to us now.
Okay.
Good job, Mike. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks, Mike. So now we're going to have Makita present their second quarter review. We have Leo and Zarin on as well.
Yes, thank you. We're both on the line. I'll start providing some broad overviews, and Aaron will get into a bit more of the specifics. I understand we've given about 20 minutes, and I think we're about 5 minutes behind, so we can probably save you 5 minutes and address it all in about 15. So if we can go to the first page with content that looks at the past quarter. Here we go. This is the end of the second quarter, June 30th. Overall, a strong quarter on an absolute basis with a 3.4% gain for the fund. The issue, as is not a surprise to you, is the markets ran pretty hot overall in the equity space. We were underweight to equities, overweight to illiquids, but even more important than that has been the execution within the illiquids, which again is probably not a surprise to you, but within private equity, some of those write-offs have gone against us, and as a result, we are lagging versus peers and our own policy. The safety reserve exposure is adequate, and it's coming down, as we discussed earlier, to match the new target policy. And if you look towards the bottom, the public markets perform in line, if you will, with peers and with, you know, our own metrics, the 60-40 portfolio as well. And you need to keep in mind that owning, you know, some cash and safety reserves that yield quite little is probably a bit of a headwind during, you know, normal times. So overall, no concerns with the public markets, and all asset classes were within ranges. If you take one step forward to the next page, we look at the year. And similar story, strong gains on an absolute level, but we are behind policy, benchmark, and peers, and in this case, by wide margins. Again, a small piece has been underweight to equities and overweight to illiquid assets. The primary detractor has been execution within private equity. We have a page that looks at attribution, and there's been, you know, a meaningful write-offs or write down valuation in some of your private equity assets at the time that private equity had a terrific year with gains, depending on clients and areas of the markets. I've seen 50, 60, or even greater returns on an annual basis. So when you lose 33% and the market is up 50 or 60, that is a huge loss, especially if you had a position about 10 to 15% of your portfolio in it. So that accounts for the majority of the lack that you see there with the performance of 9% versus the policy of 24%. The lion's share of that is execution within that private equity piece of your portfolio. Towards the bottom, you'll see very similar performance for public markets versus peers. And again, that includes the safety reserve. I just want to take a step back and look at how we were a year ago versus today, because there's been some good progress. Aaron calculated this yesterday, and the illiquid percentage of the total fund got reduced from 42% to 32%, so a 10 percentage points improvement during the last year, a combination of successful exits and write-downs in some assets. The legacy assets as a proportion of the total fund went down from 28% to 21%, so about a 25% improvement. On dollar basis, the legacy assets were about 550 and now we're at 430. So again, that's an improvement. Real estate went from 18 to 14%, private equity from 15% to 9%, and public equity increased from 29% to 40%. So some meaningful positive changes as we're moving closer to the long-term targets that were approved earlier this year. Any questions thus far?
I guess, Ryan, just maybe if we had weren't at 69 or 70% on the public, we were at our target, which I think is 80, high 80s or 90s.
It'd be 82.
Yeah.
Cash.
Would anything here not be green?
Would anything here not be green?
I mean,
we're pretty close to those bottom two as far as the 60-40 in the peer. If we were at fully at target, we'd have more in equity, so I would assume we'd be right at it and above. Peer performance on top, I mean, asset allocation would be right there. The policy index, tough to say too, but I mean, I think as compared to the public, 60-40 in peers, I think we'd be right at it. We could run the numbers you'd like, but
yeah. But I think the point is that this is an allocation issue for us, and that getting out of the illiquids into a suitable long-term portfolio is really job number one on the investment side.
Without question, and the only thing we would probably underperform is our private equity versus peer private equity, as Leo said. We're taking write-downs, and they're getting gained.
Yeah.
That would be the only anchor, even if we got down to our target weight.
Got it. Cut.
All right. So if we move a couple of pages to the quarterly change in market value, we are above 2 million, which is the first time after several quarters that we are on it. And if you skip a couple more pages towards the liquidity exposure, again, we'll see some of that improvement that I had mentioned. So we have the target on the right and our exposures on the left. And this is, meaningful improvement over the past year. Sorry?
What page are you talking to?
I was talking to the two pages above the quarterly manager scorecard. I wasn't going to spend a whole lot of time. I was going to move on to the scorecard.
Okay.
So if we can move forward one or two pages, please.
One more.
There we go. So this is something relatively new. It came, I believe, as of request from the investment advisory committee to document at all the meetings performance versus benchmarks for the public market strategies. And you need to keep in mind overall is a relative amount of short measurement. 1 year, 3 years is quite short over the investment horizon of the fund. And, some of your managers, like it was mentioned earlier, a little miss, sometimes remain in the books for a while. So one quarter can change the numbers here. And, the yes or no can be very arbitrary because it can be behind 10 basis points and it shows and now equal to lagging by 500 basis points. So with that said, you'll see a good number of greens, but three no's that are across all-time periods where the strategy has been a part of you. The first one is Manulife, which is a quality manager, and when compared to the broader ACWI benchmark, it does not look great. But again, the value benchmark is performing very strongly, is 600 basis points ahead, ranks on the 13th percentile. This is one of those, you will recall that at different times we look at the relevance of comparing against more value or growth benchmark and the core. And so I think it's good to look at all of those to get multiple perspectives. Overall, we don't have any any concerns, but, you know, it shows us no, and I think that is the explanation why, you know, it's a manager that sits somewhere between core and value, and during measuring against core over, you know, time periods on the page doesn't look very attractive, but versus value, it is performing quite well. RBC is the next one. Had a really weak second quarter performance, and that is bringing all of the trailing periods down. So the three-year now is behind 20 basis points, but if you go back one quarter, the strategy was ahead by 230 basis points and ranking the top third. So this goes to the point of one quarter can change these, and if they have a good third quarter, it can go back into the green. So I just want to caution against overreaction if we are hitting a period when a certain manager has a no across different time periods. And the last one is Pacific Asset Management, which I think you should know is a fairly conservative strategy within the bank loan space. The expectation is for it to outperform in down markets and capture most, but not all of the up market. And as a result, it's lagging that, you know, the past year and a half has been a very strong rally. Performance during the first quarter of 2020, for example, was very strong. So it is performing as we would expect. So we don't have any concerns with this manager. As I mentioned earlier, overall, we don't have any concerns or any issues to raise with you with respect to your public market strategies. And I'm going to make just a few more comments on the next page, and then pause to see if there's any questions. The next page looks at under the hood exposures by geography in your public equity book. And so perhaps the best way to look is at the chart on the bottom half of this page. And so if you start from the left to the right, you have exposure across the U.S., developed markets outside of the U.S., and emerging markets. And the blue column, the leftmost, represents the DPFP public equity portfolio, and it holds 49% of its assets, which are $850 million in the U.S. Just to the right, it shows the ACWI, so the global benchmark that we track, at 58. So we are underweight. And why are we underweight? The primary reason is that the managers that you have are favoring investments outside of the U.S. So if, for example, you look at developed markets, each one of them, Manulife, Boston Partners, Walter Scott, and Invesco have overweight to developed markets ex-U.S. and consequently underweight to the U.S. And that's why you pay them. You pay them to make those decisions. And then finally, you have RBC with the lion's share of its assets in emerging markets, as you would expect them. So the underweight to the U.S. equity piece of the puzzle is the result of active decisions by each of the managers that you're paying. Now, I caution that with the funding of Eastern Shore, this underweight will be reduced here in the coming months and quarters. So these two slides are relatively new. You haven't seen those typically in our standard reports in the past. Any questions thus far? All right. I don't hear any. I just want to point to one more page before I turn it over to Aaron, which is page, I think it's 107 out of 198, or let me see, at the bottom would be page 109 in the book. Okay, I think we're there. Thank you. So this is what I alluded early on. If you look at the blue color, that represents effects from asset allocation decisions, essentially being overweight or underweight asset classes. And if you look at global equity, the second from the top, the blue is to the left, meaning we were underweight an asset class that did well, so that was a negative. And conversely, we were overweight real estate, which as an asset class perform weaker than the funds performance and the market's performance. And so that is negative. But you see others that offset that. The green line under private equity explains essentially the underperformance by the fund. So in this case, that bar to the left is almost the same size of the funds. And that is what has driven performance for the past year. If you were to go one page forward to look at the year, it's even more evident. Can we skip over one page, please? Thank you. Here you'll see the impact. Recall 9 versus 24 with the performance of the fund roughly for the year versus the policy benchmark. So about 15 percentage points behind. That is explained mostly by your private equity performance. Private equity lost, I think, 33%. The private equity benchmark was up 50 or 60%. You had double-digit holdings. I think we started the year at 15%, and it came down gradually to about 9. So if you multiply across, you pretty much get, you know, that 12 or so percent. So 12 out of 15 percentage points is just explained by performance within private equity. And then the rest, you know, a combination of being underweight public equities when they went up and overweight other illiquid assets that didn't move much. So nothing is new. I think this has been a story now for a bit of time. The good news is as some of these illiquid assets get smaller, the impact will diminish, and now we have a much greater allocation to public markets that, as I think Nick mentioned earlier, they're more suitable than these legacy assets that still remain on your books. So with that, I will pause and take any questions and also turn it over to Aaron, who had some observations to make on this portfolio, and then we're going to switch quickly to the private markets report.
No questions, so go ahead.
All right. Good morning, guys. Aaron here. If you could go to page 106, please. All right, so I'll do my best not to repeat comments that have already been delivered. I'm going to try to hit 4 slides here in the performance report and just a handful in the private markets. So you see here a very subtle addition down in the footnotes that hopefully will be useful for trustees. The second line, you can see we've detailed out now the breakdown of global equity. So as of June 30th, you had 37% in global equity. Of that, 20% was U.S., 14% developed non-U.S., and 3% in emerging markets. EM-driven. Thanks, Bill. EM-driven from the global managers, and then you have an additional 3 from RBC.
That's a good footnote. Thank you.
My pleasure. Next page, please, 107. I think this is a nice graphic that articulates Nick's points earlier, shows the history of BPSP and the evolution of the asset allocation. So you see the top part is blue. That's public equities, so your classic just stocks. And this fund had, you know, at the minimum, at the low point, it looks like almost less than 10% back in 2017. And you can see as the new board, the new asset allocation, and Makita and staff have worked together, the blue has just continued to increase year over year. Market returns have helped as well. And you see the downward transition in the orange area, real assets, as well as in the green. The green has gone a little slower, but it is starting to narrow. You can see that there is progress being made. It's gradual. You know, it'll continue to be, go down in this path, and eventually you'll see it should look something like that bar on the right, which is the asset allocation targets. So from there, let's go fast forward all the way to 117. So I think Leo's comments were valuable on kind of progress that's been made, areas that the board can control, and then other areas where we're all working hard but still kind of at the mercy of some of these legacy assets. So I'm going to show you here on this page and the next page two of the big chunks that the board has more control over. So the global equity bucket, if you see halfway through the page, the gray line, and you can see the global equity managers are generally outperforming the broad benchmark, the ACWI IMI, over almost every time period. And you can see if that was one single portfolio, you'd be, you know, above median and in the 39th percentile over the 10 years. So it's very encouraging to see that this area that is going to be the biggest driver of the results of DPSP going forward has been working well and delivering strong results in an area that you do have control over. On the next page, please, or two pages, it looks like 119. Same story, and this kind of echoes Mike's comments, but if you look at public fixed income, so the third gray line, almost $500 million, you are, you know, if you look towards the 3-year, 5-year, 10-year, even the 1-year, delivering very strong results against the multiverse universe, and over the longer periods, almost in the top third in terms of results. So again, another area the board has control over in terms of selecting these managers and weighting the exposure. So encouraging to see continued strong results here. Unless there are any other questions, I'll skip the rest of the report. I think Leo summarized the attribution pretty well. You know, the same themes continue to be challenges, but these more liquid asset classes are continuing to do well. Any questions? If not, I'll progress to the private markets report quickly.
None, Aaron. Thanks.
None? All right. I think it's 131, please, Ryan. All right, great. So here is the remaining exposure as of March 31st. And a reminder for everyone, if you look at why the date is so old, the most private markets investments report on a significant lag of, let's say, like 120 days, 90 to 120 days. So they don't release the March 31st numbers until typically right around kind of June 30th or so. So this report is always one quarter behind the regular quarterly performance report. But if you're using this date, March 31st, you can see the biggest exposures are still in real estate and private equity. I like to look at this report relative to one quarter prior and see the changes. So during this quarter, you received $43 million out of real estate investments. That was the sale, some of the AEW Camel Square properties, and the Idaho Spring Valley. So $43 million coming back, getting liquid. This is separate from that additional, say, $60 million that Ryan mentioned came back just last month. So we're starting to see progress here, which is encouraging. You can go two more pages, please, Ryan, 133. Another thing that I looked at was, so this is the snapshot of each of the major private market asset classes. It has a lot of information in terms of what you've invested, what you've received, performance numbers on the right. But the column that says valuation, so this is the summary of all the remaining private market investments on the books. So assets that are fully exited come out of this report. But so now you have about $690 million left. I looked at the first report we ever did, which was, I think it was first quarter of 2018, and the number at that point was $980 million in valuation. So we're starting to see meaningful reductions in what remains in the private markets portfolio, which is encouraging. And some, most of that has come from distributions, not simply valuations going down.
Ryan, what's in infrastructure that was down 40%, if I'm reading that right? What was the big driver of the negative 40% in infrastructure?
Oh, it's 4%.
That's 4%?
4.13 is small.
Okay. Then,
it's the Asian infrastructure funds have been down the most. The only three things left there are the two Asian funds and the maritime fund. All three are down, but mainly the two.
Okay. I thought it was 41, reading the decimal wrong. Sorry.
Bob, small.
Yeah, the thing that really jumps out at me on this is, and there's all sorts of acronyms here that you have to be kind of an insider to know, but the one that is the TBPI, the second from the end of the right, is sort of what did you put in, what did you get out? It's like the end of the day, what's the ultimate sort of net? And, you look at these huge amounts of dollars, it's $1.5 billion, that's basically been tied up, and it's just money that's been driven around the same block for 10 or 15 years, and you got nowhere with it. And so at its kind of base level, when we want to communicate and we're talking about how to move forward, then we have to sort of be able to communicate what's happened. This is a big part of it right here, that you have $1.5 billion, and this is probably an average life of a high single digit to low teens, maybe 10 years or so.
About 10, I'd say.
But on average, so 10 years worth of $1.5 billion tied up that produced zero. And so in a sense, that's kind of time theft. Meaning that, over 10 years, you would think you could compound $1.5 billion in a public pension scenario at a minimum of a mid to high single digit number. Aaron, would you say that's a good ballpark number over 10 years average?
Oh, yeah. At least high single digits, if not double.
Yeah. So if you were to just use kind of the rule of like sevens, that would be, a 2.0 easily over that time period. So that's $1.5 billion that you didn't earn. So when we talk about, how did we get to north of 30 years, this is one of the big areas, and this is something clearly we have moved away from, but that we had to deal with. But when you have to understand it, that 1.03 right there is as clear of a scorecard as anyone would want. And then just thinking through the time implications of that, that's 10 years of return you didn't get on $1.5 billion.
Yeah, Nick, it's a very simple way to connect to a big audience. You have the plan used to be around $3 billion. So half your plan did nothing for 10 years during a period when most or nearly all markets, all public markets, performed quite well.
Yeah.
So
we own that legacy. We're not going to repeat that legacy, but we have to understand that legacy.
Yeah, to Aaron's point, this is just what we have left, though. If you look at some of the other investments that have dropped off, it's quite a little starker picture than that.
But equally, it's offsetting with some of the things we sold that were actually good,
mm-hmm.
in all fairness.
And I mean, conversely, if you look at the ag line, that's what it should look like going forward for the stuff we're keeping with multiples above one and in IRRs in the double digits.
Okay.
So I'll try to end on a more encouraging note on the next page.
Let's try, Aaron.
The good news is there isn't much more money that could go into these investments. So there's a few things to read through on this page, but this is the list of unfunded commitments. So what I would look to is the first look to the very bottom line and all the way to the right. So $13 million. So theoretically, the managers could call from you in total based on all those commitments that were made back in, you see the dates ranging from mid-2000s, some even earlier. I'll caveat that if you look at those dates, they're almost all well more than over 5 or 6 years in the past. If not even longer. So that means most of these funds are past their investment period. So while they did not call all the money you committed, they probably are unable to do so going forward. So at the most, what I'm trying to say is you have $13 million that could theoretically go into these investments, but I would say it's very unlikely that anywhere near that number would actually and could be called. So hopefully no more money into these investments with the big caveat of, excluding lawsuit money or other workaround things that might be in the works. Putting this chapter in the past and all new money going into public markets.
All right.
So we'll wrap it up there.
All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
I do want to flag one other thing that is a good common sense in addition to the TVPI, which you all can see, is you just eyeball the vintage years and all these things. That's when the decision was made. Now, it doesn't mean the money was withdrawn or invested that year because usually it's staged over 3 to 5 years. But if you just think about that, every vintage year represents a decision in this, in the board where they said, yes, we'll invest that amount for this period of time, and then just think of it from an opportunity cost standpoint of what the money didn't do if it had been put into a suitable pool of investments. Instead, it was put into these various things, and you can see the results.
All right. Anything else?
Thanks. Is there anything else from Makita?
That's it for them.
Yeah. And guys, once again, we want to end positive. The key to forward good decision making is good data and understanding what happened in the past. And that's absolutely a core part of trust in going forward, is that we all understand what's happened before and are mindful of it as we move forward. Okay, Kelly, Executive Director's Report.
Okay, so included in your information is the NC First Monitor Report, as usual. We have had two open records requests since the last board meeting. They were both from investment publications, nothing from members. As far as office reopening, we're still working on a hybrid schedule. We have restarted some of the things that we hadn't really done since we were working from home. One item was to recognize our employees with service awards that have met certain thresholds. So Cynthia Thomas, who's our lead benefits counselor, has been here for 10 years, which is amazing. That's a tough job. And Damian, who sits back here and helps John, has been here for 5 years and does a great job as well. So that's good. The other thing that we've done since the last board meeting is we did have the member meeting that was requested by the member multiple times, and it was well attended. We had 20-ish people in the room. 97 people on Zoom. Armando and Tina were present, and Mark and Ken were on the phone. It was 2 hours of questions. Basically, we did a little overview and then questions. It was intended to be active members asking questions about their benefits. 2 hours of questions, but not one benefit question from an active member. So, but the time was filled up, so we did that, and then continuing with the education programs online, which have been very well received. So that's what's going on in the office. As far as the CIO recruitment goes, in the next couple of days, today or tomorrow and Monday, I'll be finalizing my first initial round of conversations with candidates and then narrowing it down to the next phase of interviews. That's where we are with that. Any questions?
Yeah, Kelly, this is Ken on the member meeting. Could you tell how many were active versus retired? Because when I looked who was online virtual, I mean, I could kind of tell who was who. It looked like there was more retirees than there were, and some of the questions were dredging up the past again. So did you get any feedback as to how well it was received other than that?
So we can't tell active versus retirees, and we allow questions to be asked anonymously, which I think we probably won't do in the future. Some of the questions I know came from a person that isn't even a member of the system, so I don't know. People didn't have to give their names, so we don't really know. It seemed like a lot of retirees based on COLA questions and those types of things.
I mean, we were there, right? I would say the people that were physically in attendance, there was at least 50% that was retired, at least.
I agree. Just off the top of my head, I want to say that from the fire department, I recognized maybe a handful of actives and the rest were retirees. But I also want to comment on the professionalism of the presentation and how the staff handled the meeting overall. I thought it was top-notch. The fact that you guys were up there being transparent, forthcoming, it's what we need to hear. It's what we need more of on behalf of the active and retiree members. Thank you for hosting the meeting. It kind of took a left turn. It wasn't exactly what we intended the meeting to be, but the more that we could do that, I think the better off we'll be in the long run. I'm not asking for more of those, but I'm just saying that it goes a long way.
I think, to your point, Armando, I do think that you should not be dissuaded by those situations. I think it's kind of a trial and error we learned from the first time. But I think it was very important, the outreach, the education, and I know in conjunction with that is the tutorials that you have, that you post online. I just think that don't deter, just continue to do that. I mean, you are going to get situations like we had in that instance, but like Amanda said, you handled it very professionally, and I applaud that because it did take a hard left turn. So, good job. Don't be dissuaded.
Okay, so I think we're going to go into executive session now.